My name is Sandy Fehler from the University of Wisconsin Oral History Project. Today is Tuesday, June 6, 2006, and I am interviewing scientist Tony Ziegler, a member of the Wisconsin National Primate Research Center and the Department of Psychology on the Madison campus. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's start with your early history. If you could talk about where you were born, talk about your family, where you went to elementary school, high school.
Okay. I was born in Texas, Jacksboro, Texas, which is west of Fort Worth. And my parents are both from Missouri, Kansas City, Missouri. And my father had gone down to Texas, to San Antonio, to go to chiropractic school. When he finished, on his way back, they stopped in this little tiny West Texas town and fell in love with it. And so that's why I ended up being born there. As I got a little older, maybe a year or two, they moved to the outskirts of Dallas. And so that's where I grew up. I went to school there. I went to school elementary, junior high, and high school in Dallas until my sophomore year, when my parents moved 30 miles outside of Dallas. So then I returned to a tiny little town to finish my education.
What year were you born?
1953.
Did you have any brothers and sisters?
I have three older sisters, and we were all born within 5.5 years of each other. So it was like growing up in a dormitory, which is wonderful, just absolutely wonderful.
What do your sisters do?
My oldest sister, Sherry, is an artist, and she lives in northern Florida, and she also does environmental education. She works for the Water District for Florida, and so she does a lot of educating and concerns about the environment there, how to clean up, and teaching children as well as adults and so forth. My sister Karen stays at home. She's married. And then my sister Paula she was the big businesswoman for a long time and decided that she had too much stress in her life, so she quit that and sold the business, and now she just works for someone.
And are your parents still living?
My mother, who lived here in town, just died in March. Oh. So we're all still recovering from that. Mm-hmm. And then my father lives in Texas, near Dallas.
And you went, so most of your elementary and secondary education was in Dallas.
Yes.
In public schools?
Yes, public schools.
Was it a good education as far as you can remember?
Yes. In fact, the schools were very good back then. I don't think they're probably rated very high for public schools within Dallas now. But I actually went to a high school that had 4,000 students. The largest high school in Dallas. Mm-hmm. Maybe in the state, I don't know, it was huge. And then when we moved, the rest of the 2.5 years, I went to a school where I actually had 25 students in my graduating class.
Oh my.
So it was really abrupt. But I have to admit, my education pretty much stopped when I went to the small school. Caught back up when I got to college,
right,
though.
Were there any teachers that you can remember that had a particularly strong influence with you in terms of your science, interest in science?
I actually had a math teacher when I moved to this small school that I just adored. And I can remember saying, I'm going to make you proud. I'm really going to go through college and do something. And he just made math fun, and I just fell in love with math, so that was really nice.
Mm-hmm. And how did you decide where to go to college?
Actually, to be honest, my father said he'd pay for 4 years of college if I'd start out at a junior college. Mm-hmm. So I went to a community college in Dallas for the first year and a half, and then transferred to Texas A&M University.
And what was that experience like, the junior college and Texas A&M?
The junior colleges were absolutely wonderful. The small classes, really, really excellent professors who had time for you. Mm. So I just had a really good experience there. Then I went to Texas A&M.
And how did you choose that?
Well, I first wanted to go to veterinary school, and it's the only one in the state.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. It's like the University of Wisconsin. It's a land-grant school, mm-hmm. built at the same time in the 1800s, and A&M stands for Agricultural and Mechanical. Mm-hmm. So anything that has to do with agriculture, you would go to Texas A&M if you're in Texas. Engineering, it's really big there. Chemistry, huge there. So it was a natural fit.
And what, at that time, what made you make the decision of veterinary school? Excuse me. Why did that interest you?
I was just totally infatuated with animals, and one of the lures to get me out of Dallas, my parents said, I'll give you a horse. And we ended up getting several horses. Oh. You can have as many dogs as you want. Oh. So I did that. And I really liked working with the veterinarian for any kind of medical treatments for the horses. And I've really always loved medicine and just, you know, getting my hands in there and treatments and stuff. I really enjoyed that. So,
But somewhere along the line, you switched directions, or did you continue in veterinary school?
I made a different decision, but I went to Texas A&M to complete my bachelor's and to apply for vet school. So I went into a biomedical science curriculum, which was great because you get a really good exposure to all the sciences, and particularly those pointing towards medicine. Mm-hmm. And I applied once, didn't get in, and then decided that I was pretty much tired of school. So I got my bachelor's and went to work for a couple of years before I went back to graduate school.
What did you do?
Well, I ended up working at the University of Texas Health Science Center, Southwestern Medical School. Mm-hmm. And there I continued, really got to really learn science there. That was really exciting. So I worked as a medical research technician in a lab with two MD scientists who were endocrinologists. They were looking at adrenal hormones, and it was really exciting, and it was in the 70s. It was a time where radio immunoassay methods for measuring hormones were really, really just gearing up, because they weren't developed until the 60s, the later 60s. And actually, when I started there, or was applying there, I had one of my sister's friends worked in the personnel, so she was kind of leading me to different people, different scientists to interview with, and out of the people, she kind of helped me pick two that I should probably think about taking the job. Mm-hmm. The one I didn't take ended up winning the Nobel Prize.
Oh my.
So that was kind of interesting.
I'll say.
But I chose to go in the hormone direction instead of the molecular biology, which the other person was doing.
And then?
So I learned all my practical lab experiences there and decided I wanted to go to graduate school. Okay. Possibly even, I was still kind of thinking of maybe going into some kind of veterinary science. So then I go back to graduate school.
Where?
At the veterinary school at Texas A&M.
Okay.
And in the Department of Anatomy and Physiology, and just loved it. They offered me a position to work at their marmoset and tamarind colony. So, hence my first exposure to cotton-top tamarins and common marmosets, which is still my life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So
you were doing that while you were going to graduate school.
Right. Mm-hmm. So I had an RA, a research assistantship, and I pretty much managed the colony and kept all the records and, you know, spent all my extra time out there working with the marmosets and did my PhD research on them.
So what was it that when you walked into that lab the first day, or that day, or you met the marmosets for the first time, what was it that got you so excited about it? I mean, was it immediately?
It was love at first sight.
It was.
Oh, yes. It just got deeper and deeper as I got to know them better. But just the opportunity to work with these marmosets and tamarins was perfect. You know, I found my home, so to speak.
Now, what research did you do, and what?
I actually did reproductive endocrinology research. I was working with a professor there, Dewey Kramer, who did a lot of work with laparoscopy and so forth. And so, I developed this sort of enzyme way to look at ovulatory hormones, the estrogens, and we would actually go in and do a laparoscopy, you know, where it's just making a small incision into the belly and actually try to observe the follicles and see which ones were ready to ovulate. And because the marmosets, I mean, they're really different from so many other primates because they are multiple ovulators.
Oh.
So one of the things I found out was that they actually, humans usually switch. So you may ovulate on your right side 1 month and then the left side the next month.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the marmosets do that too, but they can have 4 or 5 follicles ovulating at once. And they end up having, you know, twins usually, sometimes triplets, even quadruplets occasionally. If the nutrition's right, but it all happens on one ovary, so they're switching too, which I thought was really neat.
Yeah.
So we were sort of watching this process of which ones were growing and reaching maturity to actually ovulate and then form the corpus luteal afterwards.
And were there scientists and faculty members there that had a real positive influence on you in terms of what you wanted to do with all of this work that you were involved in?
I was, which I actually think in retrospect, it was very hard, but it's probably a great way for a graduate student to learn their way in science. I didn't have one particular person that knew everything about what I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
I had specialists in certain areas, and I was kind of drawing on them to put together this process that sort of went into different disciplines.
Mm-hmm.
So I had like an immunologist on my committee, I had a chemist, I had a physiologist, anatomist. My major professor or my advisor was an anatomist.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, I would say, the epitome of the academic father. He was just wonderful. But he didn't know a lot about what I was trying to do, so I think they were kind of learning as I did.
Hmm. And how many years were you there then in the graduate
Five
program?
Years.
5 years.
I did a straight PhD program, so bypassed the master's.
Mm-hmm. And then what?
Then I suddenly realized I'd graduated. Okay, what am I going to do? Well, I ended up meeting Professor Charles Snowden from the psychology department at a meeting the summer right before I graduated.
Mm-hmm.
And so we put together a thing so that if his funding came through, I came here to do a postdoc.
And it did come through, obviously. And that what,
yes.
What year was that?
I came here January 10th, 1983.
Okay.
a cold, blustery day.
Yes.
I loaded up my car with my dog and my marmoset skeleton that's behind you.
I saw that.
That I brought from Texas
A&M.
Goodness. That he actually sat on the way, and all my possessions. And
now, had you ever been in cold weather before? I mean, really cold weather?
No. I thought 20 degrees and under all would feel the same. I had no idea what sub-zero weather felt like.
Did you think you made a mistake once you got here?
I wasn't fond of the weather.
Yeah.
And I was pretty much alone until I, you know, integrated and so forth. But loved the university, loved the city.
So what work did you do then with Professor Snowden?
Well, he brought me up here. He's of course, a psychologist, but he studies animal behavior. So his main emphasis was in communication and behavior. And I came up here to set up the reproductive aspect of his program.
Oh, I see.
So I did a joint postdoc with the Primate Center here in the psychology department. So I developed hormonal assays with help from people here to actually be able to measure most of the reproductive hormones for the cotton-top tamarin colony he has up there. And so we were able to look at ovulation, conception, pregnancy. Nobody even knew what the gestational period of this monkey was. They didn't know really how long, you know, the ovulatory cycle or so, all sorts of things. So then we started doing that and I developed into looking at different things about the family lifestyle of the cotton-top tamarin.
Would you talk about that a little bit? What is the family
lifestyle? Sure, they're fascinating. There's very few non-human primates that have a family style living like humans. And so they're wonderful models for all sorts of family interactions for humans. And in fact, that's what the National Institute of Health or the National Institute of Mental Health, NIMH, give us grants for. So working with Charles Snowden in psychology, this grant that he got right when I first came has been funded ever since. So that's been like, what, 23 years or so forth. And we've looked at a series of things that are really fascinating about these monkeys. One thing is, in this family group, there's a pair bond in male and female. They're the breeders. And then their offspring. So as the infants mature to juveniles to adults, they stay in the family and help take care of their younger brothers and sisters. If they don't do that, they can't be parents themselves. They have to have that experience. That learning is just really important for them in order to be good parents when they go off on their own. So it's kind of neat, and it's taught me a lot about what we should be doing with our teenagers.
I'll bet.
The experiences they should be getting of, you know, children.
Now, do you go out in the field and study these animals in the wild, or is it primarily here in the Primate Center?
I have several aspects of my work, and studying the cotton-top tamarins and then the common marmosets that are here at the Primate Center is part of it. The marmosets, I'm studying what makes a good father. And that's really fun work because we get into all the hormonal things and the signals that are going back and forth between males and females and pheromones. And with the cotton-top tamarins, we looked at a lot of things like why do daughters not ovulate until they get out of the family? So we know they go through a pubertal process, but they don't actually ovulate and have the ability to conceive until they leave the family. So this is a social suppression. I've done some studies. My Brazilian scientist friends work with common marmosets in the field in Brazil. So I've been down there to work with them. And then I have another colleague here, Karen Stryer, in anthropology. Yes. Did you interview her?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Karen and I are very, very good friends, and we've been working together since 1988, probably, something like that, with her woolly spider monkeys, the Moriquis in Brazil. So I've been down there a number of times because another one of my specialties is developing non-invasive ways to measure hormones. And so I actually went down and set up a whole lab at her field site so that her students that collect feces from the monkeys can process it there, and then it comes back here to the lab and we analyze the hormones.
Mm-hmm. Is that, do you particularly like that work, the field work, going out to out into the rainforest and the
it's just really exciting to be out in the field. Yeah. But whenever I'm out there, it's just for limited times, you know, in order to justify getting those experiences. It's because I'm having to do something like, once Karen Stryer and I followed some male Moriqui monkeys all day for several days because we wanted to find out if the certain hormones we wanted to look at had a diurnal rhythm. If you collect the feces in the morning, is it going to have higher levels or lower than if you collected the feces in the afternoon? Hmm. You know, so that this kind of change throughout the day, which a lot of hormones do, doesn't interfere with what you're seeing over time. Mm-hmm. So we needed to know whether we could only collect in the morning or the afternoon. So we got to run after the students and up and down through the jungle, you know, panting and so forth,
trying to
keep
up
with them.
To do that kind of
so
work.
That was fun.
Yeah.
So it's only been for short times that I've been out in the field, but mm-hmm. each time it's really, really fun.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you were with Professor Snowden and the postdoc for 2 years, or how long was that?
I think the postdoc was for like 3 years.
Uh-huh.
And then Charles Snowden helped me get to a scientist position. So I did that, but
so
I was
by that,
spending...
I'm sorry. Oh, go ahead.
I was spending so much of my time down here developing new methods and so forth that the director of the Primate Center at the time, John Hearn, wanted to get me on board. So he ended up giving me a 50% appointment here. And then that way I had a more secure appointment while the others was on, you know, more research grants. Mm-hmm.
And has that pretty much continued then, or?
Well, this last year I went up to a 60% appointment, and now I'm the director of the hormone labs here.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of interesting because I grew up in them. And
right.
It's just been great. I really enjoy that. And so I have another percentage of my appointment through psychology, working with Charles Snowden, mm-hmm. the Tamarins. And then I started developing my own area, working with the marmosets here, and mm-hmm. got funded a couple of years ago.
Talk about the hormone lab a little bit. Are there, who works in that lab?
Well, there's Fritz Wagner, who mm-hmm. was here when I first came here. And he's a manager of a certain part of it, mm-hmm. looking at maybe mostly the protein hormones.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's Dan Whitwer, who started shortly after me. So we've all kind of been here together for a while. And mm-hmm. Dan's manages the whole steroid laboratory, mm-hmm. that component. And then about 5 or 6 years ago, we hired Steve Chikaris, who is now in control of our new mass spectrometer and this whole new system of looking at multiple steroids and really low levels.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and then we have someone who's going to be leaving soon, Sam Frost, who's going to go to med school. He's just been with us for a year.
No, they're all scientists.
They all have their bachelor's degrees, mm-hmm. and they're managers of, you know, mm-hmm. their particular areas, lab managers.
So there must be some administrative duties then tied to being the director of the lab, is that?
Yes. Well, for one thing, I had to write for our next 5 years worth of funding, but this laboratory was set up at the time the director, Bob Goy, was here. It's like 30 years or so. It's been set up for a long time, and it was set up for scientists here. If they wanted to measure hormones, then there's one central area with someone with expertise. And so the person who really set it up was Gunther Scheffler, who's since retired, but we became great friends, and he was born in Germany, is one of these people that could learn anything and figure out the most efficient way to set it up. So he was really, really exciting to work with.
Mm-hmm.
And then it developed as the role of primate center started changing, and we set up a charge system, and so it got to where it was used by other people at the university and then nationally, mm-hmm. internationally. Mm-hmm. So we do work for people from Brazil, from England. We just did some work for some investigators in Switzerland. But mainly because it's, NIH, we focus on people that either have an NIH grant or their focus is non-human primates with the NIH, mm-hmm. Health and well-being, mm-hmm. sort of emphasis.
So
I have people calling me constantly.
Sure.
Oh, can you measure this and this monkey? Well, each monkey you do, for each hormone, you have a whole system of, making sure it's validated and so forth. So, mm-hmm.
How many primate centers are there in the
There's
country?
Eight.
Okay.
There were seven since the time they first started them in the 60s. And just within, I think it was the last 6 years, they opened one in Texas, which was, it was actually the Southwest Foundation in San Antonio, and then they shifted it over to a primate center.
Are they all primarily federally funded?
They're all federally funded. Mm-hmm. There's a component of NIH called NCRR, which is the National Center for Research Resources, and what it does is it funds the National Primate Centers, all eight of them, and it funds clinical centers for clinical trials,
mm-hmm.
and that's primarily what it does.
Mm-hmm. And then are there graduate students working here too, or?
Not so much. The graduate students are actually from on campus.
Well, that's what I meant. I'm sorry.
Okay, campus. So like with my projects where Karen Stryer in anthropology, mm-hmm. and I collaborate, her students come down here and I'll train them, and maybe they'll run samples for us,
mm-hmm.
to get their training. And as they're developing their projects, and then they go off and hopefully get their funding, and then they come back and they'll run their samples. Same thing with Charles Snowden, mm-hmm. in psychology. I've worked with a number of his graduate students, and they're either helping me in the lab or they're doing their own techniques or whatever. But mm-hmm. so I have a lot of interactions with graduate students.
Mm-hmm. How much time do you think you spend on grant writing?
Grants now usually are once every 5 years. And I don't know why. They always seem that all the grants come up in the same year. So you may spend a frantic year filling most of your time with grant writing.
And that's what's happening this year.
Mm-hmm. I see. And then if you do it that way and then just get it over with.
Has there ever...
Unless you have to keep going back. Right. If you don't get funded right away, then you have to write again. And
well, that's what I was going to ask.
Really,
have there been times when you felt somewhat in jeopardy because of grants not coming through or taking longer than they should have to make decisions, or
There was a lapse when I was more affiliated with Charles Snowden. We didn't get funded the first time. And so there, but he had applied for, through the graduate school, there's a program where you can apply for backup money so that you can at least cover salaries. Mm-hmm. So he had to cover a portion of my salary for 6 months until the next time around when we got the grant.
Well, that's a good program, though, to have that available.
Right.
Yeah, I didn't realize that was out there. Good. Mm-hmm. All right, so we know why you came to the University of Wisconsin. And the hiring process was really quite simple. You came as a postdoc and you stayed as a scientist, right? And
yes.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
People had appreciated what you were doing and created those appointments for you.
Yes.
Well, that's not always the way it happens.
No. In fact, I would have to say that, you know, Charles Snowden's just always, we've always had such a great collaboration. Mm-hmm. It's really neat to work with someone who you have your different backgrounds, mm-hmm. and you come at the same questions with your different approaches, mm-hmm. and it's just blended really well. So, you know, we've always had really strong research, I think, because of that. Right. And same with my work with Karen Stryer. She's an anthropologist. My background's biomedical science.
Sure.
You know, we can come at these questions from different perspectives.
What had you heard about the reputation of the department and the university before you came here?
Well, I definitely knew of the Wisconsin Primate Center because it has an excellent reputation, and the psychology department, with the blend of the two, this was the origination of, you know, that Harry Harlow put together.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hoping everybody's heard of Harry Harlow because he was quite an impressive man.
Yes.
So the reputation is really good. University of Wisconsin and the Primate Center here are known nationally, internationally, because of the big emphasis on non-human primate research. It's huge.
Mm-hmm.
The library here, which you probably well know,
yes,
has an international reputation of being the library to serve research in primatology.
Mm-hmm.
So that was certainly a big incentive to come here.
So I think you actually answered the next questions then about the national reputation of the University of Wisconsin Primate Center and what it's best known for.
Yes,
yeah.
It's very well known for always having quite a large group of scientists, professors that are working with non-human primates,
mm-hmm.
and it still is today.
Describe the facilities in which you work.
Okay, I actually do my work here at the Primate Center. If I'm working with the marmosets, I'm across the street and I'm actually doing things like, sometimes we do some hormonal manipulations, so we may be in inserting a small little pellet that will release hormones into their neck, or we may be doing behavioral observations to watch how a father responds to infant cries or to his own infant, things like that. If I'm working in the lab, I'm either training or helping students or developing some new method so that we have a different neural peptide or hormone, some other way to measure something that is something that people would want to do, scientists.
Mm-hmm.
And the lab is, it's big. It's got equipment. It's got the dinosaur equipment back from, you know, over 30 years, all the way up to, you know, state-of-the-art equipment.
Mm-hmm.
You can kind of get lost. It's like going through with a spaceship, you know, as you work on some of this equipment and get to measuring things that are so tiny, you know, you can't even imagine how small they are, but we're able to measure these and find out how they're working in the body.
Would you talk about what's going on right now with the marmosets? What are some of the things that you're doing?
Well, we just had a paper come out in February, and that made a big, big splash. As I mentioned, we've got this grant. I have this grant,
right.
And I've got a graduate student and a technician that are working with me on it. And it's all about what makes a good father, you know? Mm-hmm. Why is some dads better than others? So just like with humans, some dads are right in there. They can't wait to get their hands on the kids. It's the same way with these marmosets. Some of them hang back and, she'll do it, great. So anyway, I did the study where, it was a very simple study, but it really caught the public eye. And it went everywhere. It went internationally. I was being interviewed in Ireland on the radio, and you name it. It was about these dads gaining weight while their mates were pregnant. I don't know if you heard about it when it came.
Well,
out.
I did hear about
you
it.
Did
right.
hear about
yes.
it.
Oh,
okay.
Yes.
So what happens is the fathers start putting on weight while their female is pregnant, and they actually start gaining weight before she shows the huge increase in weight. Mm. And that's the story. But there's more to it, of course, mm-hmm. because why are they gaining weight? Well, you can look at it from a, you know, more of an evolutionary approach and say, well, they gain weight because they're doing so much of the caring of the babies after they're born, so they're fattening up for the energetic cost that will accrue during the 6 to 8 weeks that they've got these babies on them all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And they can, you know, there was a study done that showed that they, cotton top tamarind dads were actually losing weight after the birth while they were carrying these babies. Another way of looking at it is, well, they don't sit and talk. I mean, the female doesn't say, oh, I'm pregnant. So there must be some way that the male's body is responding to fattening up. And there's a communication that occurs between them. And so that's kind of the behind story is mm-hmm. how do changes in the female's hormones alert the male to the fact that she's pregnant. He's got this responsibility, and so he starts gaining weight and having hormonal changes. And these hormonal changes is all about what we're studying in this grant.
Mm-hmm.
We're finding out why some dads are so responsive and others aren't.
And how long does this grant run?
Well, I got an R21, which is a developmental grant from NIMH, and it's a 2-year grant.
Mm-hmm.
And so that one runs to December, which is why I just put in this one for 5 years to follow it along.
Mm-hmm. And is that your major study right now, or are there other things that you're doing?
Well, I'm doing that one, and then, of course, I'm working with Charles Snowden on looking at the hormones involved in affiliation, pair bonding, so forth. So they're big hormones that people have been talking about a lot. Oxytocin, mm-hmm. vasopressin, oxytocin is one of these hormones that appears to be released when you get good physical contact, you know, from a friend, a comfort or something that sort of negates the stress hormones. So we're developing a grant on that. And then Karen Stryer and I are developing some ideas on our work with the Morikis.
Would you talk about the culture of the Primate Center? It sounds to me like it's certainly a culture where there's collaborative study, which when you talk about your research, you're talking about it in cooperation with others on campus and the work that you do for others on campus mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. worldwide. So is that correct?
Yeah, I've always worked in a collaborative means, and you know, what can I do for you? Can I develop and set this up so, you know, we can look at this or whatever, because mm-hmm. a lot of this stuff just wasn't here at the time. But when I first came to the Primate Center, all the scientists would just bend over backwards to, you know, let me come in their office and say, I need help. I'm trying to do this. What do you think about this? Or do you have any ideas about this? And they just opened their labs and everything. So that was really wonderful. The center's changed a lot. It used to be we're all working together. The center now is probably more, each lab is more isolated, so to speak, because it's gone from the, you know, looking at the neural physiology behavioral aspect to more hardcore science, is like how do we cure diabetes and stem cell research, things like that. So there's some big lab people here, the AIDS research, they're big and they're sort of centered on what they're doing, and so it's not the back and forth that it used to be. But as far as the hormone labs, we like to serve the university. So when we can't usually take too many students at once. It takes a lot of time to do the training, but we do that when we can. I work with several of the people in psychology. Seth Pollock, who's really an up-and-coming professor. Kathy Marler, who does a lot of things. She looks at parenting and paternal behavior in rodents, California mice. So we have a lot of interest in common. And Seth Pollock is the one that's been looking at human kids. And he's been doing studies with these children that were adopted out of Russia and Romania that hadn't been handled for the first year of their life. And he compares them with normal children from families that they grew up with and were born with. And we've developed some assays here, particularly the ones for oxytocin, to show that there's some developmental changes that aren't happening in these kids that do normally.
Are there formal and or informal ways for you to make contact with faculty and scientists outside of the Primate Center? I mean, I realize there's a very close working relationship with the Department of Psychology from what you've said, and but what about other departments on campus, other science departments, for example? I mean, if you need something from somebody, is it simple, an easy way to make a connection with someone in other departments?
Actually, yes. It's very good. I mean, if you know the people and know what they're doing, you've usually met them through, there's a number of different kinds of seminar series on campus. And it's a great way for graduate students and professors to get together around particular emphases, such as there's one called BIDS, Behavioral Interdisciplinary Seminar Series. And so people that are interested in behavior, whether they're interested in hormones and behavior, neuroscience and behavior, so you meet the zoology, the anthropologist, the biological anthropologist, psychologist, people from the Primate Center. If it's that, you know, so that's one way that you kind of make your connections.
And those are, they happen on a regular basis on campus?
Every 2 weeks.
Somebody gives a talk, or is that, I see.
Or they bring someone in to give a talk. But it could be graduate students, it could be a professor talking about their work. So this is a great way. And then there's the reproductive endocrinology program on campus. And then they also have their weekly seminars. So those are ways. And then also, you just, I don't know from how, you usually know certain people have certain things, or say, there's been a number of times that something broke down in our lab, and we really needed that piece of equipment where we could call someone on campus. One time we were going over to Dairy 4-H and using their equipment to get the job done, so to speak. There's been times where people in zoology or biochemistry, the Weissman Center will call us and say, can we come down and use this equipment? Sure. You know, so there's a lot of that. People are definitely willing to to work.
Well, I ask that question because I know from what you've said and other scientists and faculty in the sciences that I've talked to, it's such a demanding position, and there's so many aspects to the position that I always wonder, well, you know, how sometimes things like these connections get put on the back burner, but I would think they're so important. So it's good to hear about these seminar programs and other programs to get people to
if I had more time, I would go to more seminars and I would make more connections, but you can only do so much.
Yeah. Now, do you teach?
I don't teach regularly, but people like Karen Stryer in anthropology, Chuck Soden in psychology, Kathy Marler, they may ask me to give a guest lecture. I've done that for Chris Coe, who's also in psychology and runs the Harlow Primate Lab. When you give a guest lecture, you may talk about a specific thing, such as I've gone to Karen Stryer's anthropology classes where they're learning about, you know, primates as a whole, and given talks about chemical communication and which primates use it and how does it work, or something, some specific aspect of my research that they could benefit from hearing.
Now, what about when students come over here? Or, I mean, that must be a way of teaching informally, right?
With I've done. And in fact, I've been on quite a number of committees for graduate students. Even though I'm not faculty, I can sit on a committee and be a part. I go to their prelims, their defenses, that whole thing. And so I'm involved in that.
I would think that'd be in a very important role.
I've done a lot of training of graduate students.
Well, I think the next question has to do with how your research is funded, and I think you've talked
mentioned
about
that enough.
Yeah, I mean, is there anything else that is there any local or state foundations or anything that you can go to? It's really just national, federal funding that you're looking for.
I've had Karen Stryer, and I've had funding from the National Science Foundation, but then again, government. Now, she gets funding from all sorts of places that want to fund environmental research or, you know, field research and so forth. But for actual lab research and the type of questions we're asking, we really are relying on our government. Who's not been very generous with funding lately?
Has it been cut? Have those programs been
cut? Usually there's an increase.
Oh.
And just maybe a mild increase or whatever, or hold steady. This time it held steady, but the only reason it really held steady, maybe there was a slight increase, but all that money went for work on either AIDS or bioterrorism. So the actual basic science fields, the percentage of grants getting funded is just getting smaller and smaller and smaller. So these days, when I first got here, if you were in the top 30%, you're pretty sure you're going to get funded in your area. Now you're really stretching it at 10%. If you're in the top 10% to get funding.
Boy, that must put a lot of stress on you and others.
And I don't think everybody realizes that not everybody has a secure job at the university. If I don't get this grant, my technician doesn't have a job.
Yeah.
She has no security for her salary mm-hmm. unless the funding continues. Mm-hmm. Same with me.
Yeah, yeah.
The faculty have, you know, they can fall back on their department and they're okay. But
mm-hmm. Now, so you know, each time that you're writing the grant, requesting funding, you know what the priorities are of the agency that is.
Right.
So those priorities then affect how you write your grant and how you, what you
Correct.
Ask for?
Correct. Now, if I went to the National Institute of Mental Health and said, I want to study the social structure of common marmosets, they'd say, well, that's nice. Maybe you should go to the National Science Foundation or something. But if I go to them and I say, there's a real problem in the United States, and this problem is child abuse. There are so many children that aren't being reared normally. And a big proponent of child abuse occurs with fathers. There's a lot of fathers that don't do very good parenting. I think it's essential that we learn how to be good parents. Mm-hmm. And we need to use this marmoset as the model, because look at the variability in their parenting, just as you see in humans. Mm-hmm. So then, suddenly my work's appealing to
sure.
them.
I see, right.
And it doesn't mean that I can't benefit from learning more about the marmosets, mm-hmm. as well as meeting their goals.
Mm-hmm. So not a game. It's not a game because it's too important to be a game. But you really
I think
have
it's an art.
Yes, an art. Thank you. You really have to know how to.
Well, to be a scientist, and I think it's more even difficult for faculty members. You can't just be good in the lab. You know, you can't
sure.
just be good at developing experiments and implementing them. You have to be able to write about them. You have to be able to convince others that what you do is really important, and you have to see how it can improve human health mm-hmm. if you're going to go to NIH mm-hmm. and get funded. Mm-hmm.
Now, did you expect, when this paper came out in February, did you expect the kind of reaction that you got
no.
from the world? But
no.
this is all good, right? I mean,
oh yes. Yeah, sure. It's not going to hurt my chances of funding,
right?
And because there's so many human dads that gain weight when their wife's pregnant, it really captured the attention. In
yeah.
fact, there's this whole symptom called the Kubod syndrome. That occurs in men, and they get all these pregnancy symptoms that just go away as soon as the baby's born. So
that's
people
fascinating.
When people hear things that happen in primate families or whatever, they really pick their ears up because they
sure.
the general person walking down the street believes that we're more closely related to a non-human primate mm-hmm. than you know, anything else on the planet,
mm-hmm.
so.
Now, is there any corporate or money out there that would be, or do you purposely stay away from that, or that you might be able to tap for studies, research?
You know, I think there's always pros and cons in getting business mm-hmm. involved in your research. Then you're meeting their goals, not
yeah.
yours.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we could try out some drugs for a drug company mm-hmm. on the monkeys. Mm-hmm. That's meeting their goals, not ours.
Yeah.
So I haven't really looked into that.
Mm-hmm. I know that's kind of a major issue on campus all the time as to what kind of influence corporations have on research, and I can understand where that would be a dilemma.
Right.
Okay. Well, we know where your research interests came from. What do you consider to be your most important contribution to the field?
think it's developing all these ways to measure hormones that people want to get at, being able to look at a lot of these things non-invasively, like being able to look at all these really interesting parenting hormones or filative hormones in urine, being able to develop the assays so that we know all about a female's cycling and pregnancy, and she lives in Brazil and has never been touched. You know, she's never been asked to come down out of the tree or anything. So I guess I'm really proud of what I do in the lab to enable people to learn about primates without it having to do invasive work.
Very good. Have you had research leaves where you've been able to just spend your time on your research, or have you pretty much?
I have 100% research appointments.
Ah.
So that's what I do.
So that's what you do all day. Now,
that's
what about
what I do.
Before you talked about being the head of the hormone lab, and
yes.
I think I asked you about
right.
does that include some administrative duties?
Yes, but you know, we have an accountant for the Primate Center and so forth, so people have to come through me. I have to decide if they want to send their samples here, you know, is it appropriate?
Mm-hmm.
Can we do it?
Mm-hmm.
I show them the way to get, you know, to our website that gives you the process to do.
Mm-hmm.
If I give them the approval, then I may help them interpret their data. I may do a lot of collaborative work with them, or I may be working with everyone in the lab to figure out how we're going to do this or whatever. So that kind of administrative work.
But not hiring, firing, evaluating?
Well, I evaluate the, you know, my professionals that work with me.
Okay, I see.
But they're stellar.
Yeah.
They always have been.
Well, that's great. That's great. Have you been involved at all campus administrative or committees, governance issues? Your academic staff, and I know there's an academic staff governance structure on campus,
right,
and committees, etc. Are you at all involved in any of those?
No, I'm not. I haven't been involved in that. It's just that takes a lot of time.
Yeah.
Especially if you're going to do it right, and those that do it are really committed and do a wonderful job. I think that would really tie my hands. If I was only working for myself, I could see doing that. But when I have people like Charles Snowden relying on me, Karen Stryer, and you know, number of people that I'm helping, I just don't have time.
Some members of academic staff, and I kind of talk about this from my own background, having been in the library and an academic staff member for so many years, say that they feel like second-class citizens on campus, that they're not treated with the kind of respect that faculty are treated. Do you feel that at all in your position?
Absolutely. Oh, there is no question. This university does not treat equally. And I think that is across departments. Now, it used to be worse, and I think they're, you know, moving in a better direction, but I can remember when I was first asked to sit on committees and stuff, I would actually get the paper I was getting ready to sign ripped out of my hand. You can't sign that. You're not faculty. How do you think that makes you feel? Okay? And then there's resources here that only recently have they been opening up to a scientist track person. I still, to this day, even though I've had grants from the National Institute of Health in my name, have to get permission from the director of the Primate Center to submit the grant. permission to be a PI. So, do you think it's equal here?
No, I don't. But
I'm trying not to speak too passionately, right, but I've seen so much.
Yeah.
And it's a shame because I think I've contributed a lot to this university.
Absolutely.
And I think that I have a lot of faculty members that really appreciate my qualities. So, I don't know, it's such a big university, maybe it's hard to reach down there and to actually see the inequalities.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't understand it either, but it's been here forever. And
yes, it has.
Whether it'll change or not, I don't know. But the fact that there is some movement in terms of the academic staff governance process, et cetera, is a positive move, I think.
I think so, too. But I also see the discrimination against women here. It's still here.
Well, that was going to be my next question.
Oh, okay.
I can discuss the climate for women here. How does it help or hinder the participation and advancement of women?
I would say that is very dependent on the department you're in.
Mm-hmm.
And I think some departments are very, very even in how they handle women in science. I think women in science as a whole is still a tough road. And it's not always that men are causing it. I think it's just the development of women in science to have the confidence and the focus to be able to do what the men are. But I think once you make it in your field, it's really hard to make the same advancements that men do.
Mm.
Especially in the hard sciences.
Mm-hmm. What is the ratio of male to female in the primate center on scientists and staff?
There's three of us women scientists.
Mm-hmm.
There's A. Tarasawa. Mm-hmm. She now has a faculty appointment too with pediatrics.
Mm-hmm.
There's Marina Imborg, who's new, and she's a scientist like me, just starting to make her way through. She's really brilliant. I think she'll do well.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's me. Well, then there's actually Ricky Coleman, who's an assistant scientist, struggling to get recognition for what she does.
Mm-hmm. And how many men? Lots.
A lot.
Well, would you prefer a faculty position? I mean, I don't mean it in terms of, certainly.
I would for the recognition.
That's what I was going to ask, yeah.
I'm serious.
Yeah.
I would for the recognition.
Right.
I have a reputation internationally and nationally.
You mentioned earlier that you're involved in professional organizations. Would you talk about that a little bit, what they are and why they're important?
Sure. I have been active in the American Society of Primatologists since I was a graduate student.
Mm-hmm.
And for the last four years, I've been the executive secretary for that society. So my commitment is to go to their meetings every year, and I take all the information at the board meetings. I'm involved in the executive decisions for the society. There's over 700 members. And then I put out a bulletin quarterly of all our news information and reports from students. We give a lot of money to students to help promote their research, especially if they're working with primates in the field.
Mm-hmm.
And so forth. And so then we get a synopsis of what our money helped them do, and then it gets written up, or a new finding of a primate, or any kind of really interesting stuff I can put in together, funding opportunities, so forth. And then for the International Society of Primatology, I'm an editor for their journal. So I read and, you know, comment and help improve these publications that are coming in. And then I'm also an editor for the Society for the Study of Behavioral Neuroendocrinology, SBN. And so I go to their meetings whenever I can and participate.
Do you enjoy writing?
I used to hate it. It's getting better. I've learned how to write. That was on the spot, so to speak. But I like putting ideas together and synthesizing it. And so that's the creative, interesting part of writing for me.
Would you talk about any honors and awards you've received in your career?
No, I can't think of too many honors besides receiving grants. Or I got a travel award, a young investigator travel award through NIH once. That was kind of cool.
Yeah. Where did you go?
It was to a meeting in Washington, D.C.
Oh, okay.
And then I got an award for a travel to Brazil for a meeting once.
Well, that's important. All right, now, life after work, if there is such a thing. If you would talk about your family, how you balance work and family, what do you do for fun and relaxation when you're not working? And I have to ask this question, since you were once planning to be a veterinarian and you had all these dogs and ponies when you were younger, do you have any pets?
Of course.
Oh.
So, yeah, I have two sons, 17 and 13, and a husband. And a dog named Bart, and a cat named Izzy. Bart is part Chesapeake Bay Retriever, part Black Lab. And he's just adorable, incredible, you name it. The cat is just one of those fat cats that sits around. And then my son just acquired an iguana this last week, so we're getting to know her. She's pretty cool.
Now, where do your sons go to school?
One of them goes to Memorial High School. The other goes to Toki Middle School, and they're just really neat kids.
Are they interested in science?
The oldest one has been taking a conservation biology class, and he's just been really fascinated with it. But on the whole, no. The younger one has this whole math mind sort of thing, and he would make excellent scientist, but at this point in time, he just wants to focus on football.
Ah.
He's not interested in developing his academic skills to the point of being a scientist.
So do you think he'll go to Texas A&M?
I have no clue. So I spend time with my boys, but there's a lot of things I like to do. I walk Bart, the dog, every morning, and then I go to the Y several times a week with the 13-year-old, and I do lots and lots of gardening, and I like learning about herbal medicine and growing different herbs. I make my own gourmet herbal soaps and creams, so that's one of my projects. I love the whole chemistry aspect of learning what's good for your skin and for the soaps and the creams. And so I get into the kitchen and experiment, just like I'm at work.
Now, do you get to see your sisters very often? It sounded like they're
spread
around the country.
I have two of my sisters and I talk to each other every week. And at least once a year we get together for a sort of a ya-ya experience, and so and then with our other friends in Texas and stuff.
And is your husband from Texas?
No, he's from Chicago.
Oh, Where did you meet him?
Well, I actually worked with his sister up in the psychology department. She was working with the Tamarins.
And is he on the faculty or is he on campus?
No, he's not on campus. No, he has his own business. All
right. Now, do you have time for friends?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because that's one of the questions I've been asking, because I've heard from some that life is so busy when you have children, a family, and a such a responsible career like yours, that that's one thing that's difficult to...
Oh, it is, and it goes up and down. Sometimes I don't have time to talk to any of my friends, yeah. Because, you know, I can be here till 10 o'clock at night if I have something going on I need
sure.
to do, or maybe I have to spend the weekend reading grant proposals mm-hmm. or writing a paper, or, you know, I can't get it all done during the day.
Mm-hmm.
And it's too busy around here usually anyway. We're very lucky right now.
Yeah.
But I have friends on campus
uh-huh.
that are really great. You know, I have a wonderful friendship with Karen Stryer, and mm-hmm. there's a number of women that work here that we go out to lunch together, or then they come over for a glass of wine after work.
That's
so
great.
I would like to have more time for that, but...
Well, the questions, we've gone through everything. Is there anything before I turn the tape recorder off that you would like to say?
Gee, I think we've pretty much covered everything.
Well, I really appreciate this.
Thank you.
Thank you for agreeing to do it.